As far as Buddhist-based organizations and groups in the United States, that's a very, very old tradition. And again, for anyone whom I haven't met, I'm a member of the Teachers Council and have had long-time interests, both, maybe I shouldn't say both, but in traditional practice, also backgrounds in Tibetan tradition, some in Zen, also been influenced by indigenous traditions, Native American particularly, and also Jewish and Christian traditions especially. So, and then have an interest in the intersection of meditation with psychology and also with social service and social change work. Some of my background. So I want to welcome people here for the first time. If you're here for the first time on the Wednesday, if you could maybe raise your hand and say your name and where you live, maybe start on this side. Hi.
Ian, Hawaii.
Welcome, yeah. And please, yeah.
My name is Julia. I'm in Massachusetts.
Yeah, what part of Massachusetts?
Arlington, outside of Boston.
Oh, yeah. I lived in Arlington Heights once. That's pretty nice. Yeah, I know it. I know the public transportation system well. Thank you. And anyone else here, please?
Yeah, I'm Chris. I'm also visiting from Arlington.
Yeah, welcome. Hi. Welcome. Yeah. Hi.
Joy's from Maine.
From Maine. Maine. Yeah. What part?
Between Bar Harbor and Bangor.
Yeah. Welcome. Yeah. Yeah, good, thank you. Thank you.
Mark from San Rafael.
Yeah, welcome. And on this side, yeah, hi.
I'm from San Francisco.
From
San Francisco.
San Francisco, yeah, hi.
Chelsea, San Francisco as well.
Welcome, yeah. So our usual format is I'll do a few more announcements now, or a few announcements, and then we'll have about a 8 or 10 minute break, and we come back. About 11, a little bit before 11, there'll be a talk and discussion. That's our usual format. If you come when Sylvia teaches, it's either I or Sylvia typically. Sylvia doesn't have a break. So enjoy it. And sometimes we do small groups, but typically the format is talk and some discussion. And I should say also that all the talks on Wednesday mornings are recorded, and they're available to listen to on the website dharmaseed.org, dharmaseed.org. So today's talk will go on there, and many talks from the pastor there. Let's see. So other announcements. As usual, on the back table, I have some materials. I have my own teaching schedule for the next, actually for most of the rest of the year. And a reading list, and a few flyers for upcoming events. April 7th, teaching on transforming the judgmental mind, right here. And that'll be a day long. And we typically do a follow-up group for people who want to work with that issue over time. Because for most people, all of those issues are not dealt with in one day. Not fully resolved. So I'm sorry. But that's how it works. So, and then another two-day offering is in May 18th and 19th. I'm co-teaching a two-day training on connecting our practice with working with conflict, both inner conflict and outer conflict. And that's going to be co-taught with a friend named Stephen Folder, who's visiting from Israel, where he's done a lot of frontline work trying to work with the major conflict there, collaboration with Palestinians and so forth. So we're going to do 2 days on working with conflict and connecting with inner practices. And then I also have a flyer out for a retreat that's not happening until August, which is a 7-day non-residential retreat on, or 6-day, with Oren Sofer on speech practice, which is a lot of fun. And so we go 9 to 5, for 6 days in a row. In the evenings, you get to go home and test out how you're doing. So the flyer is there, and it's a great place in Berkeley, and there's plenty of parking. So it's a good place. It's also near public transportation, and it does tend to fill up. So be aware of that. Yeah. We have room for about 45 people. Okay. So any other announcements? Hi. Yeah. Thank you. Any other announcements? Great. So let's come back. Let's aim to come back right at 11. Come back a little bit before. I'll ring some bells here. There'll be a bell rung in the bookstore. And we'll start with the talk at 11.
I need to make an announcement about a little revision to the chairs. We're asked not to put away all the chairs.
Oh, good. Well, I was wondering if you'd say something.
Okay. Marilyn.
As people are coming in, we have a few announcements that we didn't make. Yeah.
Just a quick announcement, a little change to the plan with the chairs. We were asked to leave the chairs on the sides and put away only the chairs in the center for an event later today. Also, please leave the mats and cushions in front.
Leave the mats and cushions, and you say take away the chairs in the center? In the center.
Just put away the chairs in the center and leave the chairs on the side.
Great. And then I had... I forgot to announce that I have, as usual, some copies of the book that I did on connecting inner work with social service and social change. I usually bring that. I have a few copies out on the table if you want to take a look. I think we don't have quite everyone from outside, because I know our in the bookstore bell ringer is not back yet. We have to honor her. There she is. Okay. We okay? Not too many people? Okay, good. Last week, I gave a talk that was partly to honor the poet Mary Oliver, who lived most of her life in Massachusetts, in I think around Provincetown, if I remember right, on Cape Cod. And she died, as many of you know, in January. And I wanted to both to honor her and to explore a theme that could be seen in one of her poems, a poem called The Journey. And so last time, a week ago, I explored, and many of you were here, I explored the theme of the stages of the spiritual journey. And I used as reference points the Mary Oliver poem called The Journey, and we had copies last time. And I still have some. If anyone wants one at the end, I can give you a copy of that. I'm not going to go so much into the poem today, but we did extensively last week. We used the poem as a reference point. We also used the life of the Buddha and his journey as one of our reference points. And we also used our lives as reference points. So we wanted to see how do these stages map out into our own experiences. And I mentioned some of mine, and the group members shared a lot of the ways that some of these stages seem to make sense for each of us. And so what I want to do today is to go a little bit further. At the end of last session, I invited people to, if you could, have a sense of where are you in terms of these stages. Do some of these stages seem to be what are there for you right now? And if so, what practices help you to, as it were, continue on the journey? And so today I want to look more specifically at each of the stages and very clearly and specifically say, here are some practices that we do with each of these stages. So that'll be my focus, and it'll be the invitation will be to take from the talk a sense of what resonates most with you in terms of where you situate yourself. And of course, as you'll see from exploring the different stages, we may actually be in multiple stages at once or go through all the stages in the course of a day. So I'll hope to make that clear. So that's what I want to do today. So I thought I would start by just outlining the stages. And again, these were made in reference to the poem, where I think you can find the stages in the poem, in reference to the life, the historical life of the Buddha, or life of the historical Buddha, and then in reference to our own experiences. So I had seven stages. The first, taking life for granted. Having our lives be organized by the ordinary and the habitual, where we really don't think about much else than how everyday life has been organized for us, maybe by our families, by our culture, by our communities. And so this is certainly a way of life that all of us come through, you know, especially as children. You know, we may not question things for a long time. And again, for the Buddha, this was how he was brought up in an extremely sheltered way by royal parents who had been given a prophecy that your son will either be a great ruler or a great sage. And they thought that the way to ensure the first possibility, which was their preference rather strongly, as I said last time, they more or less wanted him to continue the family business. And so they thought that the way to do that was to shelter him, and to shelter him from any sign of negativity so that he continually had only pleasure, no sign of human suffering. He said later, "I was most delicately brought up." And so in a very sheltered environment, ordinary. Now for us, some of us may have some aspects of shelter, some maybe difficulties, but the first stage is that we're really taking things for granted, more or less. There are no other horizons than those given to us. The second stage is when we have some sense, it could be of unsatisfactoriness of what we were given or presented, or the quote-unquote normal way of life. We may have some questions, some sense that there might be something more or something better, some or maybe some way of living in accordance more with our deeper values. Something comes up, and we take for we don't anymore take for granted what we've been given. We have questions. Again, it could be for different reasons. For some people, it would be there might be some kind of difficulty, pain, suffering, loss. You know, a death triggers something, and we say, you know, what's going on here? How do I want to live? Right? And so that second stage is that something comes in, you know, in some way, difficulties or pain or suffering may poke a hole in our taken for granted way of living. And the third stage can be quite related. This is the call for something more. You know, there's some, we have a sense that we want to go beyond the horizons of life that we were simply given, again, by family or culture or community. We want something more. And again, this can be quite related to what I'm calling the second stage, where we have questions develop. We may, you know, we may say, you know, there's so much pain, suffering, injustice in the world. How do I live in a just society or help bring it about? Or we may be called to different kinds of deeper meaning, right? You know, is, you know, people are nasty to each other. Can I live with love and compassion and understanding, right? And again, some of that call for something more may be awoken in us by different experiences. Last time people mentioned experiences of loss that they had that sort of led to a kind of questioning or what's going on. Or people mentioned also being witness to injustice. That's something like opened up. I shared some of my stories where that was the case. You know, where I went to elementary school in Maryland with a recently desegregated community. So I went to school with a lot of black kids, and when I would go to where they lived, there were not paved roads, there were shacks. And it was like for a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, like, what's going on here? You know? And so things open up, right? Things can open up in that way. And for the Buddha, there are the stories in the text of what are called the four heavenly messengers that arrive to shake him out of his slumbers, so to speak. And he used that metaphor of being asleep. That was probably the main metaphor that he later used for the whole notion of spiritual development, to awaken. You know, we're using another one, which is to go on a journey. And so for the Buddha, somehow he had some intuition to leave the palace. And he did so on 4 successive nights. And the story is, very archetypal story, the story is that one night he saw someone who was ill. Hadn't seen that before. You know, what is this? Don't we just sort of live well, go to the gym, eat healthy food, and have a wonderful life? What's going on? He saw someone who was ill. The next night he saw someone who was dying. The next night he saw a corpse. And he was shocked, right? What is this life about? Do we just live, have pleasure, and then die? And it was shocking for him to see the unsatisfactory quality, the negative, the unpleasant aspect of life. At times he hadn't known that. He was shocked. And then on the 4th night, he saw a wandering spiritual seeker, we would say a yogi, who was wandering. He said, what is this? What is this person? And it led to him deeply, deeply questioning his previous life. And again, something analogous maybe for many of us. And then the 4th stage that I mentioned was the departure from the ordinary and the habitual. For the Buddha himself, this was actually physically leaving his home and going on a search that lasted for 6 years. You know, for us, the departure from the ordinary and the habitual may be to meditate. Maybe it's not a physical departure. Maybe we don't go anywhere, or we don't go anywhere much. But we, as it were, the departure is more internal. And we try to live in a different way, or we have, you know, maybe we go to certain classes or workshops, or we come to Spirit Rock, or we go on a retreat. But in some way, we start on a journey. Again, it may be more of an inner journey, an outer journey, maybe both. You know, I know for myself, it's been both. You know, that I've gone away physically, traveled at times to Asia a few times, gone to monasteries, gone on retreats. So sometimes it's physically taking that journey, but a lot of it is more inner. And so you don't, in a sense, go anywhere. Maybe you change some things in your life. You take a different job, start to have different friends when you have different values, but the journey may be more inner. And for the Buddha, it was outer. He went away for 6 years, studied with different teachers and so forth. And then what I've called the fifth stage is where we really start to find our deeper voice. That's very much the metaphor in the poem. In the Mary Oliver poem, she talks about finding your own voice as you leave your house and you go into the world in the storm. And so the poem pointed to the way that the finding of one's own voice can be stormy. The fifth stage is where we may go through challenges or difficulties, right? That I presumed when I started meditating that everything would be smooth and linear without pain. And it was for a short time. And then if anyone had no pain on the spiritual journey, okay, no one here. And so under this fifth stage, I really point to what we might call the purification process, or whatever we want to call it, the learning process, the working with our challenges, with our stuff, you know, where we can do this in all sorts of ways, that we go through a process where we learn, where we come to grips with conditioning, you know, could be all sorts of conditioning, social conditioning, childhood conditioning, a lot of the conditioning just to be a human being. You know, a lot of the ordinary conditioning, we come to grips with that and we go through challenges. And this was, again, very much the sense of what the Buddha encountered. Again, we may have, from not knowing the story so well, we may think that he just sort of went, you know, he left, got enlightened, started teaching. It wasn't like that. He went through difficulties. Not always brought out, but he went through challenges, we could say emotional challenges. He had self-doubt, questioned what he was doing, questioned his teachers, had all sorts of physical difficulties because he, for a long period of time, was on a very ascetic path where he nearly died because he was starving the body. A lot of challenges, you know, and probably we would say certain things were getting worked out, but it was very difficult. So, again, for us, it may be there may be various kind of difficulties. The sixth stage, I call the stage of awakening, and for the Buddha, the account is that it was full awakening. And for us, I would say that as we go on this journey, we awaken, and it may be it's typically a partial awakening. And it really then is connected with the seventh stage, which is then we re-enter our everyday world. And when we go on a journey, we typically come back with certain learnings, certain gifts that we then apply to our world. We apply to our experience. Now, I think as you're hearing this, you can have a sense that we could go through all seven stages in one day, that we could meditate for an hour, we could be with our ordinary mind, we could notice the thought, I should meditate more. You know, we could have thoughts that are more equivalent to the second or third stage, we said, you know, or fourth, or we deal with difficulties, and then after, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes of meditation, we come back to our ordinary experience. Right, and so we may go through all of these stages in a short time, in an hour, a day. You know, it can be some of us may go on an actual physical journey, or we do a retreat for a week or 2 weeks. And I think we could see all of these seven stages in the context of a retreat, or we take a vacation sometimes. Something like that may happen. And we may primarily find ourselves in one or two of the stages for a protracted period, right? I might find myself really questioning for a long period of time before I have a kind of departure. So I'm offering this as partly a kind of a map that can be helpful sort of to sometimes to locate ourselves, you know, where am I on this map? And what I, again, want to do particularly today is to say, what are the practices for each of the stages? And point to those. And so if we say, here's where I am, then what is a skillful way to proceed? And again, I want to be stressing how the stages are interrelated, how in actuality, particularly for those of us who may meditate some every day or go on periodic retreats, that there's a way in which we may encounter all or most of the stages every day. But I think the map, as it were, or the outline of the stages can be helpful. It can be helpful to look at what we're doing. We don't always do that. We sometimes just go about things. Maybe we meditate, try to bring the principles into our lives, but we don't always look carefully. Where have I been? Where am I going? And one of the great yogis of the 20th century gave some guidance on this. This is from Yogi Berra. For those who don't know the famous Yogi Berra, he was a Hall of Fame catcher for the New York Yankees. Okay, this is what Yogi said, one of the great yogi. If you don't know where you're going, you will wind up somewhere else. Okay. So he was no doubt, you know, I don't know how he got his name, Yogi. Does anyone know? Maybe we can come back to that. Anyway, so I think the map can be helpful. So let me go through the seven stages and suggest some practices. So the first stage, again, is that of taking life for granted. And by the way, these are my own stages. This is not a traditional model. This is something that I really came to, especially by reflecting on the poem by Mary Oliver and then connecting it with the life of the Buddha and my own experience. But I think it makes sense. And it, you know, you'll find different models of the spiritual journey in different places, you know. But I think it corresponds probably to most of what we find. And I think it's a good correspondence in terms of the life of the Buddha as well. So the first is taking life for granted, being with the ordinary and habitual. Now, initially, we take everything for granted. And, you know, in a sense, our journey hasn't begun when we're locked into the ordinary habitual. But one of the interesting things is that a large part of our practice, once we've started, once we're actually in stages 2, 3, and beyond, is that we come back to stage number 1 and we look very carefully. Have you noticed that when you begin, you know, your quote-unquote spiritual journey, however you understand that, maybe you meditate, you try to look at your life and behavior carefully, have you noticed that the ordinary and habitual mind does not go away? Anyone notice that? It's the case. And in fact, a large part of our practice is actually studying in depth the ordinary and habitual mind. So in a sense, we go into stages beyond the first, but we keep coming back. You know, mostly because the ordinary habitual mind doesn't just go away because I'm on a spiritual journey. You know, it has its own momentum. If I've repeated a pattern of thinking, you know, 2 million times, it's not going to stop quickly, right? Or if I have certain conditioning, certain patterns, certain wounds even, they continue. So a huge part of our practice is watching the ordinary mind and gradually working through it. You know, and so we can look at it in all sorts of ways. You know, we can see how the ordinary mind locks us into being semi-conscious or unconscious, right, when we do things in our habits. Remember last time I said, that according to one neuroscientist, the brain does not like consciousness. Brain likes habits. The brain likes us being on automatic. The brain likes us to just do the same thing all the time with zero consciousness in ways that at least keep us satisfying our basic survival needs. That's what the brain likes. And so we go against all those habits. And so a huge part of our practice is looking at some of the modalities of the ordinary mind. And what are those? You know, one of them is, you know, a deep one that's pointed to by Buddhist practice is looking at our sense of self. Looking at our sense of me, of who am I, you know, looking at my ordinary conceptions, looking at my patterns around self, looking at my whatever, my self-image, how I present myself, how it appears in meditation, my forms of reactivity, my preferences. Again, we're not trying to so much get rid of that, but we study it closely. We look at the patterns of self. We look at what takes us away from being present and aware, and a lot of it is self-preoccupation. Or we look at the patterns of continual repetitive thinking. We study that. That's ordinary mind. You know, we look at that. We look at the sense of an external world. We look at the way that we take for granted our sense of things being there and external. That's ordinary mind. As we go deeper into practice, some of what we have in ordinary mind doesn't quite look the same. We see the way that we, in a sense, as we go deeper, actually construct the world, and we construct us, you know, with our culture, we construct a sense of self that gets organized, right? And that's something we keep on coming back to look at. You know, initially, we just see, probably when we first start practicing, we use mindfulness and we just see what are my habitual patterns of mind. And I've mentioned last time, I think quite a few times, that when I first started doing mindfulness practice, what was particularly striking for me was noting my planning mind, my habits of planning. You know, I've mentioned often I come from a family of planners. My sister actually has an advanced degree in planning. She got a degree in city planning, and she makes her living as a health planner. Very nice. Planning, very important. But we, you know, we're a family of planners, you know. It was often the case when we would get together, when the kids had gone away, from the home, and we would all get together. Before we would even say, hello, how are you doing? We would plan when we would be getting together again. You know, planning was strong, right? So one of my, you know, first learnings in meditating, oh, I plan all the time. My mind's going like that. And that's a lot of what we learn. We learn, I have this habit. Oh, I have that habit. Oh, look at that. Because if you had asked me before meditating, do you plan a lot? I probably would have said the ordinary amount, which was not true. Right? I wasn't really in touch with how much I planned. And so a lot of what happens in mindfulness is that we see how the mind works. We see our ordinary mind. And it's not always flattering. How many people have noticed that initial mindfulness experience is not always flattering? You see stuff, you know. The teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, the Tibetan teacher, he said that self-knowledge is 70% bad news. Yeah, I don't know whether that was said on the basis of a peer-reviewed empirical study. But some of what we find is not so flattering. And so, you know, that's what I found. A lot of my I also started to notice when I was first meditating, I'm not very aware of my body. My habit was to be thinking all the time. You know, I was actually a student at the time, so in some way I was supposed to be thinking all the time, right? But I noticed that habitual mind. I was not aware of my body. Also, I couldn't access my emotions very well. I started to notice that, right? So we notice, this is what we initially learn in our meditation. We learn the habits, and then we can go deeper looking into some of the other areas I mentioned, the sense of self. And so a lot of our practices. So it's helpful to know that our everyday practice actually has, almost as a central part, continuing to study the ordinary mind. Continuing to study our habits, our patterns, and then going more deeply into looking at the nature of a self, how we construct the world. You know, one form of ordinary mind that I work with a lot with people is to notice that sense of being a doer. You know, we often, you know, a lot of our lives are set up so we're doing things, you know. You know, we have a lot to get done, and so we're continually doing. Let me do this. Okay, let me make a plan. Let me do this. Let me do this. Let me do this. And there's often not much sense of mindfulness there. We're just locked into, let me do this. Let me get this done. And that's part of the ordinary mind. In the long run, it's possible to, quote-unquote, do things with a sense of presence and flow and not that sort of tightness of mind around a doer. Of course, again, the doer gets a lot done. That's very important. You know. Last week, I worked on my taxes. A lot of doing mind. Very important. Very, got things done efficiently. Very good. Right? But this is all what we look at. We look at the doer. We look, and we can even go further and start to look at our ordinary notions of time and space. You see, so it can go deeply. We can look at all the core constructions of the ordinary mind. That's, as we go deeper, those become part of our practice and becomes fascinating. How do I construct time? You know, how do I construct the past and future? Maybe we'll come back to that and look at that in some more depth here, because it's really fascinating and to look at that. And when we try to stay in the present moment, as we do typically with our mindfulness, we'll notice how we go off to the past and future. We can study that some. So I want to bring the second and third stages together when, in terms of talking of practices. The second stage is where something, there's some sense that the everyday life is not quite adequate, or there's some question, or there's some problem. And the third is that there may be a call for something more. And again, it could appear in different ways. You know, you might hear about mindfulness and say to yourselves, I'm not really present a lot of my life. I want to be more present. That would fit in the second and third stage, where it might be ethical in nature. You might say, a lot of the people around me are not so ethical. I want to be ethical. How do I live? How do I deal with being in this whatever job or whatever? It could be an ethical challenge, or a challenge, as I was mentioning, about justice or something like that. Or it could be that you have, we have certain experiences that open us up to some deeper love or compassion or insight or way of seeing the world. And we say, gosh, I want that more. You know, how do I get there? And so in the second and third stage, which I'm bringing together, you know, the question arises, it's not quite adequate, and that's two, and three is the call for something more. It's really, you know, one practice we can do is really to honor your own questions. You know, we have these questions. Remember last time I talked about, we can hear the call for something more many, many times. And typically, we hear the call, I want something more in my life. We hear it, I say, okay, I'm going to do that, and then we go back to the ordinary. So the call comes many, many times. I joked last time that we could hear the call to something deep and wonderful, you know, for the first time, for the eighth time, for the 932nd time, and still not do much, right? So one way of practicing is really be sensitive to that part of yourself which wants something deeper. And see, you know, it may come in a quiet moment on a vacation. It may come in meditation. It may come through dreams. It may come through being really moved by someone else, hearing something. It may come from reading. But to really listen for that deeper voice. You know, what the Quakers call the still small voice. Listen for that voice. You know, I like to call it sometimes, listen for your own voice of truth. And it's hard because there's a lot of static, isn't there? A lot of information, a lot of stuff we're getting through the media. How can I listen for that deeper voice? And again, one of the reasons many of us will meditate or go on retreats is that we get some distance from the ordinary stimuli, the habitual information, and we can hear that voice more clearly. So it may lead you to say, let me do what I can where I can maybe hear that voice more. It could also be to recognize that some of this may come through difficulty or loss or pain or our own suffering or the suffering of those near us. And to be sensitive that sometimes those losses bring openings. And to be aware of that and to sometimes listen for what might be a gift of something difficult. Just to be aware of that in the positive time. Just to be aware of that in a difficult time, I should say. Also, it'd be aware of your, not just the difficult voices, but the voice that wants something more. A lot of times we'll put that down ourselves. We'll say that's unrealistic, you know. And so it's, again, to honor the voice that maybe has that spirit of wonder or mystery, curiosity, wanting to go deeper. Really, when that comes up, honor it. See what it says. See what it wants to say. Really give some room for it. Another practice might be to remember what woke us up in the past and to give room for that, you know. The fourth stage is the stage that I call the stage of departure. And again, the differences between the stages may be more matters of emphasis. There may be each of these stages, as I mentioned, they may interpenetrate each other in certain ways. But certainly for the Buddha, the departure was very marked. He went away physically. And that's also the metaphor used in the poem. I'm using this fourth stage to be the point where we start, at least in the path that we follow here at Spirit Rock, path of developing mindfulness, wisdom, you know, compassion, and so forth. This might be the point, the fourth stage might be the point where we actually take up our core practices. I take up a practice and I try to be regular at it. And I try to bring it into my life as much as possible. So this is where we have a sense of the core practices that are important for developing further, you know, and we have a pretty wide range of practices. We have, you know, as I mentioned early in the initial sitting, we have the practices that develop samadhi, that stabilize the mind, the practices that help us have better sustained attention. Really crucial. We're really distracted. So one practice is the practices that develop more concentration. Crucial to develop those. A second is the whole area of mindfulness, to be more present, to see clearly what's happening. These are the practices we sometimes call insight. There are the heart practices that develop more kindness and compassion and joy. And that these are our core practices, a part of our core practices here. We may develop those. We may also say, I'm really disconnected from my body. A fourth area of practice may be by having a body practice. It could be doing yoga or qigong, trying to really be aware of the body as much as possible. Really crucial for those of us with Western conditioning. Because we are largely, the exceptions to this, but the conditioning is largely not to be so aware of our bodies. You know, that short story from James Joyce, where it says, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. Right? And so body practices were crucial for me, many different kinds of them. All of these are crucial. And then how do we start to apply all of this in daily life? A whole nother area of practice and emphasis, right? And, you know, you're hearing basically the outline of the set of practices which when we go more deeply into it, we actually may be doing some version of all of these. Maybe not at the same time, of course, but over time, or we may emphasize them more. We may also be called to work with psychological issues. In the West, there's an integration of working psychologically with the practices I mentioned. For most of us, some psychological work is important, and I bring this in here by giving a lot of emphasis to the theme of transforming the judgmental mind, which can get at a lot of our childhood conditioning, self-judgment, and so forth, right? And then we also, I think, in a complete path, we'd also work through our social conditioning. So I hope you're not getting tired hearing all these areas, but this is the map of practice, right? We all have social conditioning around race and gender and sexual orientation and age and religion and educational level, and it affects us, right? The part of a habitual mind is around our social conditioning. How do we work through that, right? And so I think at this fourth stage, we get interested in developing. We don't do all of those at once, and maybe over many years we start touching them, and we may only work with one or two of them for a given year or two or three. My major practices from my first 5 years were pretty much developing more stability of mind and mindfulness. That was it, kind of my first 5 years, and coming back to the body. Right? It was those were my core practices. And so then the fifth stage is where I've placed kind of working with the challenges. And so this is where we might actually know that working with some of our personal difficulties or things that come up in life is fully part of the path, fully part of the journey, and that we can have different tools, meditative tools, other kinds of tools to work with challenges that come up, inner challenges, outer challenges, relational challenges, challenges at work, and so forth. And this is sort of where I'm placing that we can have a lot of different ways. And that may be an emphasis for us right now. Some of us, it may be, I'm really working with that tendency of mind. And you can see how with each of these, we also keep coming back to working with the ordinary mind, right? In each of these stages, a lot of the stages are really sort of let us look in a different way at our usual conditioning. And so maybe in this fifth stage, we work with the challenges of life. We work with difficulty, grief that comes up, and so forth. And we also open to the beauties, right? The fifth stage isn't just about difficulty, but it's about opening to greater love, wisdom, compassion, wonder, sense of mystery, connection with others. And I think that goes hand in hand with working with difficulties. That we learn those beautiful qualities probably most profoundly when we go through the difficult situations. I think Thomas Merton has a line where he says, "Love is only learned in the moment when the heart turns to stone, or after the heart is turned to stone." That's where we go through the bigger learning. And then the sixth stage, we got there, awakening, yay. And so in all of this process, we have insights, we see things. Every moment that we just are with the breath and know we're with the breath, that's a moment of awakening. One teacher that I met a long time ago, the teacher of Joseph Goldstein named Munindraji, he had a phrase where he said, "Breathe and know that you're breathing, and the whole spiritual path opens up from there." Right? And so we have just to be aware and present, that's a moment of being awake. And we just try to bring more and more awakening into our lives. And some of it's gradual, and some of it is immediate. Sometimes we gradually become more awake, and sometimes we just have this moment of awakeness, or something breaks through at times. It can really occur in different ways. The Buddha said, "Knowledge is achieved by gradual training, by gradual practice, by gradual progress." And there are also moments when we have a more sudden awakening. And so question is, how do you bring those moments of awakening into daily life? How can I be more present in this activity or that activity? You know, it's a lot of what we teach when we teach speech practice. How can you be awake with the more complex activity of talking or giving a talk? Right? How do you do that? You know, how can you be present and awake doing the dishes? You know, we learn in the simplified training situation of meditation, but we want to bring that quality of being awake into everything. That's the direction. How do you do that? That could be a practice you ask. And maybe you emphasize one thing. Okay, I'm going to do daily meditation, and I'm going to do these two daily activities and try to be awake there. Maybe every time I'm doing the dishes or cooking, I'm going to try to be present. Okay, I mean, we take initially everyday situations which are the easiest. We don't start with the hardest. The hardest for me is bringing awareness and mindfulness to being on the computer. There hasn't been yet a spiritual guide to being on the computer that's been published. I think maybe in a few years. But very interesting to me to do that. But we find, what are the easier situations? Maybe it's every time you take a walk, you do walking meditation. I think that was one of my first. I was a student in Boston, and I took public transportation all the time. I did a lot of walking, didn't have a car, and I was a meditator, and I was frustrated. I didn't have enough time to meditate. All of a sudden, I had the brilliant insight. Every time I'm walking, I'll do meditation. I'll do walking meditation. Suddenly, I had an hour more every day. Right? Maybe you do that. Maybe you walk and you do the dishes, and that's how we bring awakening into daily life. So how do we do that, and what supports us doing that? That's seventh stage, is where we bring that awakening into daily life. And we bring the gifts, the insights. What's going to help us do that? Maybe for some of us, it's daily meditation, or it's having a teacher, a regular teacher, a mentor, having friends, being part of a group, a community. What are the supports that help me to keep on bringing my practice into daily life? What helps? You know, one practice that I've mentioned that I've been doing most of the last 35 years is doing a Sabbath practice where one day a week I go away from the ordinary. You know, and I don't always do it the whole day, but I do it at least half a day. You know, and some people I work with, they do it for 3 hours, a little bit like going to church or synagogue or mosque or whatever. And so we ask, what's going to help? And so the whole journey, the whole set of these seven stages, actually, we go through a process, but we end up only coming back to what? Being right here and as awake as possible. That's this journey. Being right here as awake as possible, and all of what's been mentioned in terms of seeing the stages and asking what practices are good for me, you know, if I'm primarily working at this stage, it's all for that purpose, to come back, to be able to come back and be present. So I think I'll just read, there's a famous passage from the Zen tradition about how we start, it's kind of a version of these seven stages, without stages. Okay, so this is from the Zen tradition. And then what you'll listen, you'll basically hear three stages. You know, ordinary life, and then seeing things differently, and then coming back to the ordinary, but in a different way. It's kind of like the ordinary becomes extraordinary. Okay, so here it is. Before I had studied Zen, I saw mountains as mountains, and rivers as rivers. Okay, that's the ordinary. Okay. When I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw that mountains are not mountains, and rivers are not rivers. It's the middle parts of the middle stages. But now that I have got the very substance of the teachings, I am at rest. For it's just that I see that mountains are once again mountains and rivers are once again rivers. I think I'll end with that. It's I gave a somewhat linear model, and we end with a non-linear expression of the same thing. So let's just sit for a moment and just see for yourself what applies to you. What practices apply to you? What stage do you think, or what stage or stages do you most connect with? And given that, what practices are the most important for you right now? And then how might you keep them going, let's say, in the next week? So thank you for your kind attention and for having patience through all these seven stages. So we have some time now for any questions or reflections or requests for clarification, really anything. And we have microphones, so you can wait for the microphone to come to you. You can just raise your hand and the microphone will come to you. Any question or a reflection, or could be a sharing of one of the stages yourself. Yeah, please, on the end here.
So I found myself planning how I might be mindful each day for the next 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Why not?
Yes. The short answer is yes. And I think I was clear, but I hope I didn't put down planning too much. But yeah, if you only plan, you know, it's very possible to keep on planning for the future, right? This is very common in our culture, right, that we plan to get to this point where we plan to get to this point where we plan to get to this point so I can finally retire and do what I really want to do, but then by the time we've retired, we forgot what we really wanted to do. So, so the planning is important, and then how to implement the plan. So, I appreciate the humor. Yeah, please.
I wasn't here last week, so that's a disclaimer, because as I started to meditate today, my intention was that I noticed I keep going back to sleep. Yeah. You know, I always like that roomy, yeah. I don't know if you're familiar, I don't know the whole thing, but I always remember the important part is don't go back to sleep.
Yeah.
The world is all these wonderful things. And so this was very helpful to me today, because what I was feeling is kind of a loss of a freshness or distinction in my practice, that it was just easy to say, oh yeah, I should be doing this now, but I mean, you know, if I were being more mindful, I would decide not to have another cookie or, you know, something like that, and then just going, oh, but I want that cookie. So the part was recognizing, not so much whether I had the cookie or not, but recognizing that I was disregarding the opportunity and looking at that desire as opposed to just saying, no, I just want it. So
right.
Anyway, this was very helpful.
Great.
Kind of refreshing things for me.
Yeah, so the kind of two major themes, I think, for me were raised by your reflections. One of them is to how do we keep our practice fresh? And, you know, hopefully one of the possible fruits of a talk like this is that it can help freshen practice, right? Because it's really crucial to stay fresh. It's very easy for our sense of mindfulness to become itself habitual. It's really like to get organized by habitual mind, in other words. You know, I think you were pointing to some ways that can occur. You know, and how do we keep it fresh? One of the ways we keep it fresh that I think you were pointing to, the second point I wanted to bring out, is to really have some curiosity. And we would, from a technical point of view, we would call this inquiry. It's one of the factors of awakening. Can I have curiosity about my experience? That I notice that I want a cookie, I don't just tell myself good or bad, but I say, okay, it's basically follow the instructions. Desire for a cookie is coming up. Let me be mindful of it. Let me notice it, right? Rather than just say, you know, get to criticizing oneself or just saying, okay, let's stop meditating. It's time for a cookie, right? You know, so you can actually, what's it feel like to want a cookie? What's going on in the mind and body and heart? That would be a kind of inquiry. Inquiry really helps with freshness, right? Because the aspect of curiosity about one's experience, and it could be the curiosity about how does my habitual mind work? How does my habitual conditioning work? It's actually really, really interesting to study it. How does time work? How does my sense of, oh, let me look at that. So one of the ways to develop freshness is have curiosity and inquire, you know, and when something comes up, instead of just saying good or bad, but actually look carefully at it. What's going on? You know, not easy, you know, because sometimes when we have that strong inclination, we just want to do it, right? And a lot of times it means being willing to look at something that's not so pleasant. There's a cartoon, actually, somewhat directly related to what you said, which I like a lot. It shows a young meditator, and she's meditating, and she says, today I shall stay in the present moment, unless the present moment is unpleasant, in which case I will eat a cookie. Right, and so can I look at the unpleasant, or can I look at that wanting? You know, it's not always easy or pleasant to do that, so we need some energy for that. You know, another way of staying, there are a lot of ways to stay fresh. It's a great question to ask, how can I stay fresh, or how can I be more fresh, you know? So it could be maybe you hear a talk, or come here, or you work with a teacher or mentor, because they can help bring that out, or you do a retreat or something like that. That really helps tremendously. Another one is to just be really aware when the mind is just getting in. There's a, I'll just say one more point there. There's a very common state of mind which we call sinking mind, which is an occupational hazard for meditators. And it occurs when we're kind of in a pleasant, somewhat pleasant state. Kind of pleasant, not very aware, kind of pleasant, a little bit dreamlike, kind of thoughts a little bit, and it's, some of us may even think, I've arrived. But it's actually, again, it actually has a low level of awareness, but there's a certain amount of settledness and peace, and it's actually a state of relative confusion. And so we can look out for that. You know, and when that's occurring, we can do something that basically brings more energy into the system. Stand up, you know, maybe walk at that point. So we want to look out for that state. Yeah. Okay. Please, Chris.
Yeah. And what on that point is that it is, for me, it's easy to flop into that habitual mind.
Yeah.
And even if it's a pleasant, dreamy habitual mind, it's still a habitual mind. And the techniques, one of which you taught me, is to break the spell of the habitual mind. One is counting, breath
yeah.
has a great break it up, break the spell.
Yeah.
And then like body scans can be yeah. really helpful.
Yeah.
It's just because it's funny, you'll get into a routine with your practice and it becomes routine.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Very, very helpful. Yeah. How many of us can relate to that? That there are ways that our practice gets very routine, a little bit rote, not so aware. Yeah, very common. And we it's great. I think I like your suggestions. Almost to have some personal, almost like a plan. Okay, what do I do when I think I'm in kind of this rote meditation? What can help break it up? And maybe you do this technique, like you do a body scan, or maybe you stand up, or maybe you count, or maybe you do you really use inquiry or something like that. But to have two or three ways of both, of getting out of that, pleasant but not very present state can be really helpful. Yeah.
I like your idea.
Yeah, please.
Of taking a Sabbath day.
Yeah.
Because only having a few hours is not quite enough to just get you into a space where you want to make a change.
Yeah.
So I'm going to work on that one.
Great, yeah. Sabbath day has been really crucial for me. And it doesn't have to be on a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. It can be, mine is actually today, Wednesday, so I come here off in the morning and then I take the rest of the day and do a kind of a practice time. I stay here, But I work with a lot of people to develop that Sabbath, and it also helps keep the intention. It gives some priority to what for many of us is most valuable, right? That if I, once a week, even if it's for 3 hours, it could be for half a day, could be for a whole day, that I'm, to use contemporary language, I'm unplugged, I'm not doing email or text or whatever. To have a regular time when you disengage in that way and just almost like do what nourishes just you, right? Meditate. I often would meditate, take a walk, maybe do some reading, go into the wilderness some, and do that for half a day. And have it be the same day every week, and it basically helps with the freshness, it helps reinvigorate, and it helps place it. I mean, the reason why something like a Sabbath has been around, in multiple traditions all over the world is that it actually is really helps to keep the priorities clear. And you have to make it something that's even routine and habitual. See, they're very important place for good habits. I don't mean to just criticize the routine. Good routines are very good. Okay. Anyone else before we finish? Okay. So let's just sit for a few moments. And again, to come back to how you'd like to take what was most important for you from our time this morning. For many of us, it'd be related to the talk and the stages and the practices. What do I take from this? But maybe for some of us, maybe you could appreciate the talk, but maybe something else occurred to you this morning, totally unrelated to the themes, and that maybe was most important. So let that be there if that's the case. Just be with what's important that helps give you some guidance for the next period of time. What's your intention coming out of the morning? We end with the usual traditional practice called the dedication of merit, where we remember that we practice not just for ourselves, but also for others, and may the benefits of our morning be there for all beings, which includes us.